This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Are you ready for a big change in sea levels? It could happen. New science says the present gradual sea level rise is not a guide to the future. Despite the models and the IPCC, during past warming events, seas rose very quickly, swamping coastal land. We could have up to 3 meters higher arrive not just this century, but any decade now. Nobody is prepared for that. Not China, the U.S., not Bangladesh, nobody. We'll explore the new warning with the lead author, Pankaj Khanna. But the sea level rise will be unevenly distributed because the land is still adjusting from the weight of massive glaciers that have disappeared now. New England shores are sinking for geologic reasons, even as the seas rise. But rising land in some parts of Alaska makes it look like sea levels are falling there. The deniers love that. Looking into the depths of the earth, we do know why, partly due to the life work of our other guest from Canada, Dr. Richard Peltier. In the end, we will explore the big dark with rising YouTube news commentator Cenk Uygur, host of The Young Turks. We have a recording of what he says, and it's what we're all bursting to say about the news and climate change. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Before we get to the startling news about rapid sea level change events, let's find the background on how this strange planet really works. Our first guest invented the formula that determines the relationship between glacial ice cover and sea level in any climate, including our future. Sometimes my curiosity backs me into corners much deeper than I am. Of course, that is why we call on world experts to bail us out. This time, I was reading an article in the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution, which claimed that melting glaciers are causing havoc. More perplexing, glaciers that vanished over 10,000 years ago will add to the rising seas of climate change in some places, but bring falling seas in others. Of course, that's a global denier's dream. You know, the seas are actually falling. How could Al Gore be right? But come on, does the Earth's crust have an active memory? That's what we need to know. And that was a good article by Jenny Chin that I read in September 2016. But who could straighten out those mysteries of ghost glaciers? The article points to a Canadian scientist who found a way to measure and predict all that, and we're using what he found. Dr. Richard Peltier is a man with many titles, located in Canada. He's professor of physics at the University of Toronto. Peltier is the director of the Center for Global Change Science. He has been the principal investigator of the Polar Climate Stability Network and the scientific director of something called SciNet. Peltier is a man who looks inside things like waves moving deep inside the ocean and the physics of planetary interiors. Despite his pivotal role in global research into glaciers, he prefers to be called just Dick. Dick Peltier, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Glad to talk to you.
I appreciate your sharing this time. I really do. Let's start with New England, where we have lots of listeners. Anybody who lives near the shore there knows it's changing because the sea is rising, but it's rising faster in New England than in some other places around the world's seaside. Why is that?
Well, there are several reasons for this. I mean, probably the most important one is that the entire East Coast, including the New England region, is subsiding. That is, the surface of the land is sinking into the sea, not as a consequence of the action of global warming causing the expansion of ocean water and thus rising sea levels, and not because of the current continuing loss of mass from the great ice sheets at the poles, but simply because Canada, at the maximum of the last ice age, was covered by an over 4 kilometer thickness of grounded ice. And while this ice was in place, it pressed the surface of the earth down under it, and this caused the land outside of the ice-covered region to be uplifted to produce what we call a proglacial forebulge. Since this mass of ice cover was lost from Canada, the Canadian landmass has been rising out of the sea, and the entire U.S. East Coast has been sinking into the sea. So a very large contribution to the rise of sea level everywhere along the U.S. East Coast, including New England, is associated with this process of what we call proglacial forebulge collapse.
Well, that's not good news for New York and New Jersey when the next storm surge comes.
No, it certainly isn't. And that region of the coast, closer probably to Baltimore, in fact, is the region where the amplitude of this proglacial forebulge was largest. And its collapse is currently contributing on the order of a millimeter per year, every year, to global sea level rise. Not associated with the ongoing process of global warming, but rather associated with the influence of the last ice age.
I don't think we're going to get too deep into this topic without learning one key phrase, which is glacial isostatic adjustment. Can you explain for the layperson what that is?
Surely. Basically, when there is a large mass of ice imposed on the surface of the planet, and I spoke earlier of this roughly 4 kilometer thickness of grounded ice that covered Canada at last glacial maximum. If this ice is resident on the surface of the planet for long enough, and here I'm speaking of times which are longer than a few thousands of years. In fact, this last ice age occurred over a time scale of 100,000 years. And given the presence of the ice, initially, the land beneath the ice is pressed downwards by a perfectly elastic effect that is an almost instantaneous reaction to the load of ice. But as this ice is continuing to reside on the surface, eventually the interior of the planet begins to flow as if it were a liquid at a rate which is determined by the effective viscosity of this solid, which is behaving as a liquid. Matter flows out from under the region that was ice covered into the periphery, causing this forebulge region to be elevated. When the ice disappears, the reverse process occurs. Material begins to flow back under the once ice-covered region, causing the surface of the solid Earth to be uplifted. So if you look today, for example, in the Hudson Bay region of Canada, which was near the center of ice cover during the last ice age maximum, what we observe is that sea level is actually falling in the Hudson Bay region at the rate of about 1.5 centimeters every year. Or put it another way, the land is uplifting with respect to the sea at the same rate, about 1.5 centimeters every year. This rebound effect is the effect that is associated with the glacial isostatic adjustment process.
Yeah, I think I read that somewhere in Alaska somebody managed to open up a new golf course on the foreshore because some new land appeared for them.
Well, Alaska is a little bit of a different story, in fact, because the Alaska region is one in which the sea level is very strongly affected by earthquake-related processes, right? The entire coastline of Alaska has been subjected over the past many, many thousands of years to extremely intense what we call dip-slip earthquakes, which cause a very profound response of the surface of the solid Earth with respect to the sea as well, effects which have nothing to do with the glacial isostatic adjustment process, but rather with basic seismic processes.
And what about Britain and Scandinavia? They were under heavy ice loads. Are they rising now?
Yeah, I mean, Britain and Scandinavia, very closely related processes. In fact, the northern part of Britain, Scotland, and the contiguous regions across the North Sea of Norway and Sweden, that entire region at last glacial maximum was covered by a single sheet of ice, grounded ice, that connected these regions together. The southern part of it, England, in fact, was not ice covered. And at that time, at glacial maximum, the entire English Channel was dry land. That is, there was a land bridge that basically connected the southern part of the UK to the continent directly.
This makes me think about Brexit not really working at that time. But anyway, all right.
No, they were even more intimately connected than they have been in the past decades.
Well, now, Dick Peltier, you solved a basic problem of mapping out how this whole legacy of past ages operates. Could you tell us as novices about your system?
Well, the methodology that I've developed to help understand the connected issues of glaciation history and relative sea level history is a mathematical problem that's actually very closely connected to issues that have been solved prior to my becoming involved in this area by seismologists who are interested in the elastic, what we call elastic gravitational free oscillations of the planet, the ringing of the Earth, if you like a bell, which is caused when a massive earthquake occurs. What I'd been able to do was to take the basic theoretical structure that has been used to explain this ringing of the Earth bell, which occurs subsequent to major earthquakes, and to recast it into a form which enables a detailed description of the variations in the shape of the Earth and the history of local sea level by solving a complicated equation that I call the sea level equation. And this was accomplished basically in the mid-70s and 80s, and since that time, the theory has become further elaborated, much more detailed, and able to explain a wide variety of different observations that are connected with the ice age-related deformations of the shape of the planet that have occurred as a consequence of glacial loading and unloading. And the theory is now being applied to help us to understand the sea level history that is being caused by the global warming process as it leads to a continuous diminution of the ice cover on Greenland and Antarctica, for example. So the theory has come to have a very, very wide application.
So we can go forward and backward with it. We could also help reconstruct past climates.
Yes, in fact, one of the major applications of the theory now, and it's one which my own group is very deeply involved in, is using the theory to determine what the boundary conditions of the planet were in terms of ice cover, in terms of the varying bathymetry of the ocean that was caused by the growth of these massive land ice complexes. So what we're doing is using the theory to produce boundary conditions for times in the past that reach back through the most recent 100,000-year ice age cycle. And what we're doing is taking these boundary conditions and using them in the context of modern climate models, the same models that are used to simulate the global warming process, so that we can reconstruct what climate would have been like at these past times. And the work has led to some very, very interesting explanations for observations that had never been explained previously.
And there have been a series of reconstructions called ICE 3G up to 5G, and now I guess coming 6G.
7G was published about 3 months ago, 2 months ago.
What are they?
Well, these are basically models of the variation through time from about 30,000 years ago until the present of the changing ice cover on the planet, the changing paleotopography of the planet with respect to sea level, and the changing level of the sea everywhere throughout the global ocean basins as a function of time from about 30,000 years ago until the present. And each of these, each new edition, if you like, of the model, the global model, is driven typically by new discoveries of data that hadn't previously been assimilated into the theoretical structure. So we keep revising the model, improving the model continuously as new data become available. The most recent model, the 6GC model, is basically being employed internationally now in the context of what's called the Paleoclimate Model Intercomparison Project, in which the boundary conditions that I provide are being exercised by basically all of the global climate models that are employed in making global warming predictions of our future as a means of determining how accurate these models actually are. That is, by testing them outside of the region of parameter space, we call it, outside of the region in which they've been tuned to enable them to make global warming projections. So this whole process is playing a critical role now in our understanding of the climate system as a whole.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. Our guest is Professor Richard Peltier from the University of Toronto, Canada. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'd like to draw on your other research domains of climate change and the Arctic to explore what I see as a parallel problem. A few years ago, UK geohazards expert Dr. Bill Maguire published his book, Waking the Giants, and he said land rising from the weight of glaciers triggers already existing fault lines into more earthquakes or volcanoes and eruptions. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, that's been a topic that's been exercised a lot over the past roughly 20 or 30 years. The notion that the rebound of the crust due to the unloading of these massive ice complexes that existed at glacial maximum could be today responsible for triggering new earthquakes. I should say that this whole topic is very seriously debated on both sides of the issue. It's proven to be very difficult to actually discover, with the possible exception of Scandinavia, of Norway and Sweden, evidence for the occurrence, unambiguous evidence for the occurrence of this deglaciation-induced seismicity idea.
Can glaciers actually sort of cap off or diminish the possibility of volcanoes that exist under the ice? We've just seen an example of one going off in Iceland, and there was a discovery recently of a chain of volcanoes under Antarctica. Is the ice a factor in suppressing those?
I think in Iceland it's quite conceivable. Again, the arguments have been presented on both sides of that issue, but clearly the Iceland case is a very, very special case because Iceland sits on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, right under a hot spot, if you like, an upwelling of hot material out of the interior of the Earth. And it gives rise, of course, to intense volcanism on Iceland episodically. You know, whether there has been any significant role played in that volcanism by variations in the ice cover over Iceland itself is really very difficult to establish in an unambiguous way.
Changing horses here. We love to watch the waves on the ocean, but you track waves that move below the surface. I didn't even know those existed. Could you tell us what's going on down there?
Well, this is an extremely interesting area, and it's one which is, in a way, closely connected as well, or at least connected, to this issue of global climate change associated with ice age processes. Let's talk just for a minute about the modern ocean and the interior wave field which exists throughout the volume of the modern ocean. That wave field, we believe, is very strongly produced, in fact triggered, by the motion of what we call the barotropic tide, the roughly 12-hour periodic tide that exists in the volume of the oceans and which corresponds to motions, horizontal motions of seawater right down to the base of the ocean at very slow rates, but in a highly periodic fashion. So the motion of this water over bottom topography in the ocean gives rise to waves which are called inertia gravity waves. And collectively, these waves are referred to as an internal tide. So they are a consequence of the astronomically forced tide, but they constitute an addition on top of that astronomically forced tide, which consists of this family of internal waves. The interest in these waves is that when they break, and they do break rather like ocean waves on a beach, they produce a mixing of the interior fluid of the ocean, and this mixing basically affects or causes or forces a vertical flux of mass in the internal body of the major ocean basins. And it's this vertical flux of mass caused by mixing associated with breaking of the internal tide that enables the very cold, salty, deep water that forms at the poles of the planet to rise up from the interior, right, and to complete what we call the overturning circulation, meridional overturning circulation of the oceans, or MOC, M-O-C. This meridional overturning circulation of the ocean has a huge impact on climate. And so the study of this internal wave field, this field of inertia gravity waves, has come to be a very sharp focus of work in physical oceanography globally.
Well, aside from climate, I'm gathering from what you say that internal ocean waves could help feed living things if they're causing an upwelling, and also help, well, you're talking about the distribution of oceanic heat.
Yeah, the upwellings, of course, are associated with, rather than simply with the wave field in the ocean, with the nature of the circulation of the oceans itself. These upwelling zones, of course, are highly productive. And, of course, when you think of the equatorial Pacific Ocean, right off the west coast of South America, for example, during El Nino Southern Oscillation events, when the upwelling of cold water adjacent to the west coast of South America basically ceases, there's a massive impact, of course, on ocean productivity locally. The Peruvian anchovy harvest, you know, is one of the things to which we, you know, typically point in looking at the way in which time variation of this component of the ocean circulation impacts ocean productivity.
Getting back to the inside of things, we walk around on the crust, that is the Earth to us. What is the mantle, and does what happens there affect us?
No, absolutely. The mantle of the planet, broadly speaking, is the region from about roughly 3,000 kilometers in depth, about halfway to the interior, to the center of the Earth, up to the surface, or up to about 100 kilometers below the surface, right? So this region is solid, whereas the core of the planet, or at least the outer core of the planet, is liquid. So this solid part of the planet is the part of the planet which is able to flow as if it were a liquid when a stress is applied to it on a sufficiently long time scale, such as during the glacial loading and unloading process. So this mantle of the Earth is the region which is probed by the glacial isostatic adjustment process. And we can use this glacial isostatic adjustment probe to determine what the effective viscosity of the interior, the solid part of the interior of the planet, is. And this is proven to be the most powerful means of our establishing quite precisely what the value of that viscosity is. Of course, the mantle is also involved, rather like the oceans, in fact, in a circulation of its own kind, right, of its own region, which is associated with the thermal convection process. The fact that the core of the Earth, again about halfway down to the center by radius, the core mantle boundary, we call it, is at a temperature of between 3,000 and 4,000 kelvins. It's extremely hot. And because the difference in temperature between that boundary and the outer boundary of the planet itself is so large, the entire mantle is caused to convect like a liquid, rather like water in a pot which is put on the stove and heated from below. So there's an intense convective circulation in the mantle that is occurring on very, very long timescales, and it's that circulation which is responsible for the continental drift process, for plate tectonics, and all of the processes that are associated with plate tectonics. So there is a very deep connection, if you like, between the glacial isostatic adjustment process and the manner in which analyzing this process enables us to infer what the effective viscosity of the mantle of the Earth is, and the mantle convection process, which to explain physically requires knowledge of the effective viscosity of the interior. And my own work has actually demonstrated that the viscosity of the mantle that we infer on the basis of glacial isostatic adjustment analysis is precisely the viscosity which is required in a theory of the mantle convection process in order to explain plate tectonics. So there's a very deep connection between these two modes of motion, if I can call them that, of the solid outer part of the planet, which we refer to as the mantle.
Do you think that climate change has already diverted what might have been the next ice age?
Well, that's also a very interesting comment. Short answer is yes, probably, although the timing of what would have been the onset of the next 100,000-year ice age cycle, right, is not precisely known, even though for the last million years, this 100,000-year ice age cycle has been an almost metronomic occurrence, right, in the history of Earth's climate variability. The magnitude of carbon dioxide that we've released into the atmosphere since the beginning of Northern Hemisphere industrialization is sufficiently strong, even now, to have strongly inhibited any tendency of this 100,000-year ice age cycle to continue. And so the probability of its continuation, given the continuing rise of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, very highly unlikely.
Dick Peltier, from your long career studying multiple fields, what concerns you most about our future?
Well, I mean, I think the concern we all have for the impact on planetary habitability that's associated with the global warming process that's caused by greenhouse gas increase is probably the greatest challenge that human civilization has faced since its rapid evolution, beginning probably around the middle of the last of these 100,000-year ice age cycles. This is an absolutely crucial issue which the global political system has yet been unable to come together to formulate a clear collective response. And I'm saying this even in the face of the Paris Climate Accord that was signed in late 2015. It's beginning to look as though the possibility that we will live up to the commitments under the Paris Accord are highly in doubt. And this is a huge concern to all of us who, you know, have a genuine desire to see to the continuing viability of human habitation. This is a huge concern to us all, whether the international community will ever be able to come together to take the collective action that's needed is highly questionable at present.
You know, there are some scientists who suggest that geoengineering could preserve what's left of the Arctic ice cap, and that might be necessary to preserve a livable climate. I'm not so sure. I am sort of a doomster. I think we're headed into that ice-free state that Earth has had for many millions of years in the past.
Well, you know, there was an interesting CBC piece done last night, actually, on the news on exactly this issue of geoengineering. The difficulty with all of the several different geoengineering solutions that have been suggested is that they normally would involve a catastrophe should they fail. And the probability of failure for any one of these geoengineering solutions, I would argue, is extremely high. So there's no answer from my own perspective to the problem of what we should do other than beginning to take dramatic steps to curtail greenhouse gas emissions. I'm very, very dubious that any of the geoengineering solutions that have been suggested could ever work.
What should science undergrads look for as the next important research frontier?
Oh, dear, now that's a very broad question. Well, this area, I think, is one that is going to continue to attract scientific attention of many of the brightest young people that are considering careers in science. But in the general area of the overall area of scientific research, of course, there are many different avenues of development which are occurring simultaneously, you know, including deep learning and its application basically to all areas of science, including the environment.
We've been speaking with Dr. Richard Peltier, professor of physics at the University of Toronto and head of other scientific initiatives. His system of measuring deglaciation and its impact is used by scientific bodies all over the world. Find links to follow up further in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Dick, thank you so much for educating us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Now we will hear the news that governments, the public, and most scientists really have not yet digested. Sea level does not creep up regularly as shown on all our charts. During warming, it can rise rapidly in steps. Steps that could easily displace hundreds of millions of people in a few decades and rearrange the world as we know it. Over the past few centuries, humans have recorded a predictable and relatively gradual rise of the oceans. But a new study from scientists at Rice University warned that isn't how climate change worked in the past. Mapping out extinct coral reefs off the coast of Texas revealed a warning: seas can and do rise in sudden steps. I remember Dr. James Hansen told us we could see up to 3 meters of sea level rise by the end of this century. And I don't have to tell you what that means for global cities built on coastlines or the human project in general. But how do we know this can happen or that it has happened? Pankaj Khanna is the lead author of a paper published in Nature Communications on October 19, 2017. The title is Coralgal Reef Morphology Records Punctuated Sea Level Rise During the Last Deglaciation. Pankaj got his master's at the University of New Delhi before traveling to Rice University in Texas for his PhD. He has worked extensively there with Professor Andre W. Droxler. From Houston, Texas, Pankaj Khanna, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you for having me here.
Thank you for joining us. So, as a beginning, how can coral drown?
Sure. The corals, the way they work is they need specific parameters to grow. And they need specific lat and longe, which is like they usually grow between 30 degrees north and south. And they need certain salinity conditions, water temperature conditions. And then the most important one is the sea level, the closeness to the sea level. So they like to grow with the sea level. Now, if something happens due to which there is a sudden rapid rise in sea level, such that the rate of rise is faster than the growth rate of the coral reefs, then they can drown.
By drowning, really, doesn't it mean that they're getting below the level of light that they need in order to keep going?
Well, yes. But if you see, the photic zone is 100 meters, or it varies around the ocean. And these reefs, where they want to grow is around like 5 meters or 5 to 10 meters of water depth. So they want to grow in like very, very shallow water depths. And the sunlight can reach much, much lower than that, but the conditions aren't good enough for them to grow if they are like below certain water depth.
Last June, we had coral expert Charlie Varon on Radio EcoShock, and he talked about past extinction events for coral over the half billion years of their time on Earth. But when discussing climate change impacts, Dr. Varon emphasized ocean acidification and ocean temperatures too high for the codependent organisms. Why does your paper point to rising seas as a driver of coral extinction during warming events?
Sure. So this paper is talking about the last deglaciation. And by last deglaciation, I mean last 20,000 years, during which the sea level has risen up to 120 meters. So in general, if you see, there are cyclicity in the way the glaciers melt and the sea level increases. And it is 120 meters in every around 100,000 years, since like past several thousand years. So what has happened is, within the last 20,000 years, the sea level has risen, so it is a warming world. So now, how did the sea level rise in the warming world is exactly what has been pointed out in this study. And why we are saying it's more ocean rises, because there are like some spectacular morphologies, which are called as terraces, and have been observed on all of these reefs. So there are around 10 reefs, around 1 to 2 square kilometers in their size, and around 120 kilometers apart on South Texas shelf. And they've recorded 6 events, 6 terraces, which can be mapped on each of these reefs. And the way we define a terrace is a flat area bounded by steep slopes. So now we have all of these terraces on all of these reefs. The question was how you can form these terraces. And the only way to form terraces is, in our specific study, is by sudden or rapid sea level rise events. And that's why we are saying it's because of the rapid sea level rise events that these reef morphologies were modified. And at a certain point, all of these reefs just died together. And it was around 12,000 years before present.
Well, let's get on board the research ship Falkor, operating off the Texas coast. Tell us about that ship.
Sure. So it's owned by Schmidt Ocean Institute, which is owned by a former Google owner, Mr. Eric Schmidt. And this was the third expedition of this ship, and it was a test expedition. And we went into Gulf of Mexico on this ship with biologists from Texas A&M Corpus Christi. Now, this ship is equipped with latest multi-beam sonar, with which you can get a resolution greater than half a meter in resolution. And then you can also have, we call it seismic data, shallow seismic data. So we can actually look below the Earth up to around 40 to 50 meters, what's present below the surface of the seafloor. And then there were like several other equipments which were utilized by biologists to understand the biology which is now present on these reefs.
Now, I know this is a stupid question, but how do you know you were looking at coral and not just plateaus of the ocean bottom?
Well, this is a perfect question because you have to know the geological history. So what we geologists do is we try to understand the origin of the system, the growth of the system, and then demise together. So the way it all started was, you can actually see that around 3,000 square kilometers of seismic data, sub-seafloor data, was collected on South Texas shelf within the last 20 to 30 years. At the same time, my advisor, Professor Droxler, was already conducting research on these reefs on South Texas shelf. Now, before my advisor started in 1990s, already in 1970s, there were researchers who went down there on some smaller submarines and collected some data, and they found coral rubble on top of these banks. And then they also found a lot of morphologies which are only found on coral reefs, on modern coral reefs in Caribbean. And that's how we kind of came to an idea that these reefs could be coralgal in origin. The next thing is that these reefs haven't been drilled. These reefs have never been drilled. Only whatever data has been collected is just a kind of grab sample. You just go on top, collect some sample, and come back. And so it has been a big mystery. But if you see on Texas shelf, there are modern reefs called as flower garden banks. And those reefs are coralgal reefs growing right now in the modern ocean, and they are made up by coral species such as Acropora palmata, Acropora cervicornis, which are the major framework reef builders in the Caribbean right now. So now the question is, if the flower garden banks can have these coral species, what species will our banks have? And that's how getting the analogy from these flower garden banks, which are a little bit east of our location, we kind of came to a conclusion that our reefs were built by major framework building corals, such as Acropora palmata and cervicornis. And it's mostly because these reefs, first of all, grew 40 to 50 meters in less than 8,000 years. And then second, the proximity of other modern coral reefs having these species.
So that 40 to 50 meters is vertical growth, I'm presuming?
Yes. But that vertical growth, 40 to 50 meters, now is buried. Half of it is now being buried by the sediments which come from rivers. And these days, a lot of sediment is, as you can see on Google Earth or Google Maps, there are a lot of sediments of silicic clastic origin coming into the ocean and which are now burying these reefs, and these reefs are only partially exposed now, and it's around 20 to 25 meters which is currently exposed on the seafloor.
Now, I was reading in the paper about the concept of coral backstepping as a response to warming periods, and it seems like each of the new steps is smaller than the previous plateau below it. Is that because they're putting so much energy trying to go up rather than out, or why does that happen?
Yes. So this is a phenomena which is caused due to stress on the system. And the stress in this situation is caused by rapid sea level rise events. So as soon as the sea level rises, the reefs are put under stress and they shrink. And the way they shrink is they backstep. And this methodology or this way backstepping kind of produces terraces on these reefs. And what has happened is through time, since the reef started growing, there were these rapid events which were being recorded in the morphology of these reefs. And like every other terrace as it was formed, kind of caused the reefs to shrink up to a point of time when there was no surface area left to shrink, and all of these reefs died, and all of these reefs are currently preserved around 60 meters below sea level.
And when did that happen? When was their final demise, if you want to call it that?
Around 12,000 years ago before present.
Okay. Now, as it happens, I just interviewed Dr. Richard Peltier from the University of Toronto, and it's my understanding that he created a math formula to determine the relationship between the amount of ice on land and sea level. Did that play in any way into your research method?
No, not that. But what played an important role in our research is to compare these reef high-resolution reef terrace record to high-resolution climate record, which is available through Greenland Ice Cores, and it's called as a Greenland Ice Core Project, in which people studied the ice cores to understand the climate during the time period of the whole last deglaciation. So by looking at that climate record, we were able to now compare these reef terraces to the warming periods which are now present in that climate record.
And you also worked on a paper about coral in the Indian Ocean. Can you talk about how coral history there compares to what was found off Texas?
Definitely. So in the Indian Ocean, I'm working in Maldives. And in Maldives, what we are trying to do is to compare different terraces on different atolls. And also, we have some multi-beam data around Malé Island, the capital of the country, Maldives. And there, the idea was to compare scuba diving transects with the multi-beam data which we have of Malé Island. And what we see there is you do not find very high-resolution terrace record as we find on South Texas Shelf. So there, what is preserved is we do see terraces. There are about 9 of those terraces. But those 9 terraces are from the depth of 120 meters to zero water depth. And the reefs on the South Texas Shelf, there are 6 terraces within about 95 to like 60 meters of water depth. So you can see already just within 35 meters, there are 6 terraces which are very, very high resolution on South Texas Shelf. But in the Malé Island, the story is very different.
This is Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith with my guest, Pankaj Khanna from Rice University in Texas. We're talking about new science showing sea level can go up in bursts during climate change. Well, now to a hard part. It's my understanding we don't have sea level records for periods shorter than about 1,000 years. And without that certain dating, how can your team discover sea level changes that might have happened within 100 years such a long time ago?
Yes. You're absolutely right, but there are records of up to a few centuries which show dramatic rise in sea level called as meltwater pulses. So the ones which are most famous are meltwater pulse 1A and meltwater pulse 1B. And within a few centuries, like 200 to 300 years, the sea level rose up to 15 to 20 meters during that time period, with the sea level rise rate as fast as 40 millimeters per year. And if you see the sea level rise rate today, it's only 3 millimeters per year. So what we knew was that sea level could rise up to 40 millimeters per year during the last deglaciation, and it has been dated. In our case, we do not have any of the dated material. So what we did, we came up with a model, age model, which we derived from the current terrace depths, as well as the glacial isostatic adjustment. This is a correction which is required to be made due to melting of the glaciers. And the third thing is subsidence. So how much the land has subsided since the initiation of these reefs on South Texas shelf. So using all of these parameters and putting it all together, we came up with the age model of the start of the reef and the end of the reef, and also for all of these terraces. Now the interesting thing to see is, if you see the climate record on the Greenland ice core, there are about 5 to 6 warming events which match really well to our terraces. And that kind of, you know, gives you already an idea that these kind of events were existing. Right now, we do not have the exact age or amplitude of all these terraces, but we have very clear idea that if you go now with a ship and drill these reefs and date them, you will find the exact amplitude and the timing of these terraces, and which would come from a decade to a century.
If I read the latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, it predicts a gradual but relentless rise in sea levels from 1 to 3 meters perhaps in this century, depending on what we do about carbon pollution. What are you describing? I mean, if we were to see such an event happen, say in 2050 or something, what could happen?
Well, we are not prepared for that. And what would happen is, like, there will be a dramatic rise in sea level. And no model has taken into account these kind of events that our paper is showcasing. So the idea now is that all the future predictions need to incorporate part of this study, and this kind of study that we have conducted, it's first of its kind. It's needed to be replicated in other parts of the world, and we need to prepare for that, because if you imagine, like, within like a decade or two, if the sea level rises up to a meter, that will be devastating, because we are only preparing until like 2100, like the start of the 22nd century, that is like a sea level rise from 2 to 3 meters. But if it happens way earlier, then that would be devastating for the coastal areas all around the world.
Right. We'd have to basically evacuate some coastal cities which have hundreds of millions of people living in them, and we don't know what would happen to the world economy. So it's a pretty important question that you're working on.
Yes, it surely is.
Are you aware of any proof or reasons why we should believe that just because this has happened in the past when you studied that it could happen again?
Well, yes. First of all, if you look at the reports, like for future predictions, the sea level is supposed to rise, yes? And if we go, like the geologists, the way geology works is, in general, like we say, present is the key to the past. But in this case, you know, we have understanding of the present, how fast the sea levels are rising. We now are having more understanding of the past, how sea will rose in the past. So we have to use the modern understanding and the past understanding to predict the future.
Well, I was asking about, do we have any real proof or indicators that what happened in the past could happen again in the future?
The proof is that we had a warming world during the last deglaciation, which is 20,000 years. So the Earth has been warming. And right now, we're also warming the Earth at the same magnitude, which would cause the sea level to rise for sure. And to understand how the sea level would rise is very important. But if you look at the past geological record, we know that around 120,000 years, 120,000 years before present right now, the sea level were at least 3 to 5 meters higher than the present sea level that we have. So we have the understanding of how much the cyclicity of the sea level varies. We know how much, like, how the sea level has risen in the past. We have to utilize all of this understanding for future predictions.
Now, according to the paper, sea levels rose pretty rapidly, and then they paused for a while, and then they took another big step. Do we know why?
Yes, this is most likely due to ice stream or ice sheet collapses. So if you see Greenland ice sheet and the Antarctic ice sheet, what you see there are like big icebergs falling off and like ice sheets are collapsing. And you can imagine if big chunk of the ice sheet collapses suddenly, then the sea level would rise very, very sharply. During that time period, the sea level would be fast. And during the other time period when the sea level rises, the ice sheets are melting only gradually without like major ice sheet collapses. That's the time period when the sea level is only rising very, very slowly or gradually.
Well, we have huge risk here to massive deltas where agriculture is important in many countries, to low-lying countries like Bangladesh and the Netherlands. So I'm wondering, where does this science of sea level rise need to go next?
The next would be to prepare for the possible inundation due to sea level rise. And that would be to understand how fast an area like Bangladesh and Netherlands are subsiding in comparison to the sea level rise to get better estimates. And I would say that they need to start preparing now for the future because we do not have the understanding yet of how soon that devastating future can come. So we need to start preparing now.
We've been discussing new science on what at least 5 levels of extinct coral reefs can tell us about the way sea level happens during climate change. Our guest is the lead author of that study, Pankaj Khanna, from Rice University in Houston, Texas. The paper is Coralgal Reef Morphology Records Punctuated Sea Level Rise During the Last Deglaciation, as published in Nature Communications. You can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Pankaj, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you for having me here. It was a pleasure.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Recently, a massive atmospheric river covered the Pacific Ocean from Asia to North America. It was a line of storms seldom seen. TV weather forecasters were mystified. What could it be? Here is Cenk Uygur, host of The Young Turks.
Well, we've been telling you a lot about strange weather events. It's almost as if someone or a whole set of folks predicted this, maybe a whole category of profession called scientists. Well, we got hit by hurricane after hurricane. We got the droughts that led to the terrible wildfires in Western United States. And now we have what is being called an atmospheric river. What in the world does that mean? Well, you're about to see. It is a 5,000 mile long belt of rain. What in the world? Let me show it to you. It stretches from China to the United States. It is a 5,000 mile belt of storms. What have we done to the planet? They have these both cool and scary phrases for this. It's also called rivers in the sky because it's so long and it's obviously rain and moisture in the air and so intense that it has formed a river in the sky. Oh my God, what have we done? So now this is not the first time that we've had this. There was one back in 2009. It is not a sign of good things to come. If we start to have these more frequently and more intensely, I don't know how that it could get more intense than a 5,000 mile belt of storms, but this is picking up momentum, man. Yes, climate change makes a difference. Yes, they told you that the warm air would pick up moisture from both the ground, causing droughts and wildfires, and from the ocean, and it would create bigger storms. How's a 5,000-mile storm for you? Another thing that scientists that are tracking this call this is the big dark. Because for 5,000 miles, there's nothing but clouds in that belt, and it's the big dark, and it is headed in our direction. Well, it's in already hit the state of Washington. Let me tell you about that. At least one city in Washington set a daily record for precipitation Wednesday, and Seattle was expected to have its wettest 24-hour period since February. Think about that for a second. It's not like the state of Washington isn't already wet. It's known in America as the wettest area in America. It rains all the time. We just broke a record in the state of Washington for precipitation. Gee, I wonder if there's something going on here. I wonder if the scientists were all right that we are going to have more precipitation and more storms. More from the state of Washington. Strong wind gusts knocked out power to more than 54,000 people in western Washington. And a ground delay was temporarily placed at Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. According to King 5 TV, ferry services were temporarily closed as well. Look, the stories that I'm reading, I don't know if they're afraid to make the connection. Will they seem non-neutral? Do they need to have 17 scientists on the record to talk about it? But not a lot of talk of climate change. I'm not afraid to talk about it. I can see it with my own eyes. The scientists predicted that we would have massive storms. Now we have 5,000 miles of storms, the big dark. And people are wondering, oh, well, you know, that might be a shame if climate change happens later. Son, you're in climate change. You're in it right now. What more do you need? Do you need a 10,000-mile storm? We had how many hurricanes hit? Harvey, Irma, Maria. And those are the ones that just happened to hit U.S. territories. And then the wildfires that was raged for months in Montana, let alone the devastation they did in California, and now the big dark. Yes, it's climate change. Not one storm is or weather pattern can be directly connected. And you say, okay, well, it rained today. It must be because of climate change. No. But overall, when you look at the macro picture, and you see the intensity of these storms, it is exactly what was predicted. In fact, it is coming quicker, heavier, and much more intense than even scientists expected. Become a member of the Young Turks. TYTNetwork.com.
TYTNetwork.com bills itself as the largest online news show in the world. Cenk Uygur is the reason, I'm sure, and it's partly why I check their show, The Young Turks, out on a regular basis. Thank you for listening this week, and my thanks to everyone who supports this show. Please tell your friends and your electronic friends about Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith.